Hello all, welcome to the Book Spider podcast, in which hosts Patrick Barney, myself, Hans Berger, and Chris Malmberg discuss various works of literature. In this episode, we're chatting up a classic work of British fiction, The Mayor of Casterbridge by Thomas Hardy. The Mayor of Casterbridge begins with a truly startling, inciting incident. The main character, Michael Henchard, sells his wife and baby daughter to a stranger for the sum of £5. Having done this in a drunken stupor, Henchard wakes up the following day to immense regret. He searches for his wife and daughter for months, but because he is unwilling to describe the circumstances under which he lost them, he finds no one who has information about them. He does make a solemn vow not to drink alcohol for 20 years, but this vow does not seem to have any effect on his search. He has lost them, seemingly forever. However, Chapter 3 picks up about 18 years later, when Henchard's wife, Susan, and now grown-up daughter, Elizabeth Jane, come searching for him. They have spent these last two decades living with the man who bought them from Henchard, a sailor named Newsome, as wife and daughter. However, Newsome has been lost at sea, and Susan, a simple woman, has decided to seek out Henchard, to whom she believes she owes allegiance as her true husband. Interestingly enough, Susan also believes she owed allegiance to Newsome, as if Henchard's selling her had been legally binding. Susan and Elizabeth Jane now find Henchard in the town of Casterbridge, his oath to remain sober still intact, which has seemingly enabled him to become a prosperous corn factor, that is, grain merchant, and the well-respected mayor of the town. Upon finding out about Susan's return, Henchard gives her £5, as if to buy her back, and comes up with a plan to have her and Elizabeth Jane re-enter his life as his new wife and stepdaughter. From this point on, the novel primarily deals with the friendship-turned-bitter rivalry between Henchard and a newcomer to Casterbridge, the Scotsman Donald Farfrae. Henchard first employs Farfrae as the manager of his grain dealings, and he takes to the younger man immediately. However, Farfrae soon gains popularity in Casterbridge for his good nature and business acumen, to the point that people prefer to interact with Farfrae over Henchard. Henchard grows increasingly jealous, which leads to bad financial decisions. As Henchard's star descends, Farfrae's star rises. He grows rich, becomes the mayor when Henchard's tenure is up, and even ends up living in the apartments that Henchard formerly rented. Henchard, in contrast, loses his fortune and becomes a haytresser for Farfrae, which was Henchard's original employment at the beginning of the novel. Meanwhile, Susan passes away. Elizabeth Jane seeks out some form of independence from Henchard, who has become distant after learning that she is not actually his biological daughter, but rather Newsome's, his own having died shortly after the sale. And Farfrae marries Lucetta, a seemingly wealthy woman from Jersey who was formerly the love interest of Henchard. Incensed at the marriage, Henchard challenges Farfrae to a fight to the death, but doesn't actually go through with killing his enemy even when he ends up with the upper hand in the fight. Later, it becomes public knowledge that Henchard sold his original family for £5 and that he and Lucetta had once been lovers. Terrified that Farfrae will find out about their previous relationship, Lucetta has a kind of hysterical episode when some townsfolk make effigies that are clearly meant to be her and Henchard and parade them around. This hysterical episode ends in her death, and though Farfrae ends up recovering soon enough and marrying Elizabeth Jane, Henchard notes that he has lost everyone he has ever loved, Susan, Elizabeth Jane, Lucetta, and even Farfrae, and eventually dies of grief. When Elizabeth Jane learns of Henchard's death, she considers how lucky she is to be fairly happy when otherwise life seems to be a drama of pain. So that is a pretty, hopefully, fairly comprehensive summary of the novel The Mayor of Casterbridge by Thomas Hardy. Is there anything that I missed that seems like we should talk about or mention in the summary?
No, that seems quite comprehensive.
Okay. I found it kind of hard to put that summary together. This novel is fairly intricate in its, like, you know, dramatic plot turns and twists and all that. But, you know.
Somewhat notorious for that intricacy, if I remember right.
Is it notorious?
Yeah, and I mean, this is based on, you know, half-assed internet research, to use the Rewatchables term, but Hardy actually spoke of it critically. Because it was published serially, and he felt like he needed to have some kind of dramatic event in each chapter to drive serial publication, and he felt like when it was all consolidated, it was kind of too busy at a plot level as a consequence of serialization. And that's right. I don't think that I would have agreed with that critique had I not read it. I can see why somebody would think that. It's not a thought that I had reading it myself. I didn't mind that aspect of it. And I think to some extent, actually, that's kind of characteristic of a lot of Victorian fiction, probably for similar reasons.
I agree. I think it is.
It is a famously busy novel from a plot standpoint.
Right. Yeah. Agreed. It didn't bother me. I find all the plot twists and interactions to be pretty interesting, but I can see what you know people are talking about.
And I mean, so I think there are lots of, it's not like things are left at a loose end or like things happen that aren't adequately set up, right? So, I mean,
right.
It's busy, but I think it's well managed in spite of that busyness. Not to kick off your rhythm of your first question, but.
Yeah. No, that's okay. I mean, that's interesting. It's not something I'd considered. Is there more we want to say about the busyness of the plot? I do have a plot question later, so maybe we'll hold on that for now and then get to that again if we need to. Does it sound acceptable?
Yeah.
Okay. So the thing that I'm most interested in, and the thing that I want to talk about first is your reactions to Henchard. I find him very fascinating, like a deeply fascinating, interesting character to read about, but he's also kind of a deplorable person, right? So how do you react to him, and how does Hardy manage to pull off what I think is a really, really good novel? I really enjoy this novel with such a deplorable person at its center, if he is able to.
I was thinking about this because, as always, you send the questions ahead of time. And one of the things that occurs to me is basically after the jump of, is it 18 years?
Yeah.
18 years, we come back and we're with Susan and the daughter. And when we see Henchard again, he's at the height of his powers, but it's actually then where his powers are already eroding. And I actually I thought about that as kind of like almost a kind of an interesting choice, because there is sort of a little upswing in his fortunes and in his business when Farfrae becomes, you know, starts working for him. But we are introduced to Henchard, and he has all of this power and he has all of this admiration, but it's already kind of eroding. And it kind of is like, there's not really a moment that we spend with Henchard where he's not afflicted with some kind of thing that's going wrong.
Right.
And I think that that's really essential. Like basically like for someone to do what he does in the first scene of the novel, and for us to have any sympathy for him ever, he kind of always has to be beset by something. And it is like sort of an interesting craft choice, because it, you know, like he doesn't have to be, I was thinking of Othello, the very beginning of Othello. Othello's not beset by anything. Othello's like at the height of his powers. He's commanding. He is admired. He just has one guy who doesn't like him very much. But like Henchard has, you know, like a problem. He has a financial problem. He has a business problem. It's kind of already sort of like eroding his confidence.
Right.
And I think that is needed. Some bad corn.
Yeah.
So basically, like, he has, you know, people in his town who are pretty mad with him.
Right.
And he can't fix that situation. And all that to say, I think it's important that he's always sort of like throughout, he's always fighting something. And I'd say even from the very beginning, I don't know if it's like foreknowledge of the book or if it is just sort of different ways in which it is written, or if it's like a kind of a stylistic thing in the way it's written. It feels just sort of, it might be sort of like, you know, osmosis, me knowing about this book, but it felt like he was doomed from the very beginning. And and it's easier to sympathize with someone, even if he's reprehensible, when he's doomed.
Mm, that's a good point. Sure. You know that, you know, whether or not you know he's doomed, or you just understand that he is currently and then continues to be facing a lot of pretty serious issues, that definitely makes you empathize with him a little bit more. Like, you know, you're naturally going to empathize with someone who is in a state of conflict or in a state of pressure where he's not certain he's going to be able to get out of it or how he'll get out of it.
And I didn't know, actually, I didn't know he was doomed. I really, until he died, it seemed plausible to me that he could possibly at least reconcile with Elizabeth Jane and develop kind of a kindly uncle relationship to her or something like that, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I didn't assume a tragic end for, I just didn't have the contextual knowledge to know that would happen. But I still found him very sympathetic, actually. I mean, obviously, you know, his kind of initiating, his first initiating incident, the inciting incident at the very beginning of the novel, obviously is appalling. But even that, I mean, it's not like it comes from an inexplicable place, right? It's not like it comes from a place that's totally remote from feelings that you might be able to understand.
Sure.
It, you know, you're grindingly poor.
I think about selling my wife and children every day.
You're grindingly poor. You're in a marriage to somebody that you probably don't even like very much, because the nature of the society you're in is such that, you know, right, you often marry young to people that you don't know, and you quickly, you know, grow apart. And the fact that he regrets it deeply the next morning, I think obviously that doesn't forgive it, but it makes it easier to kind of place it in context within kind of a more complex character, right? And
right,
everything I think that we see him do or say, or every behavior we see after that, I think comes from a very recognizable, it comes from a set of emotions that we've all felt something similar to at some point or another, right? Like,
sure.
Farfrae is this, even though it would be better for him to not be a dick to Farfrae, even though that's not a rational thing to do, it comes from the jealousy that we feel, the kind of personal insult that we feel when someone comes along who is in many ways just kind of a more, a person who is similar to us but behaves and moves and lives with more grace and ease and attractiveness in an instinctive way, right?
Right.
Kind of like how I felt when I met Chris. And that, I think everybody's experienced that particular kind of the rage at the world that one feels when you have to live in the shadow of somebody like that for some period of time. And
absolutely.
So, I mean, I think that it's everything that he does comes from such a place that we, it comes from a place that has enough overlap with real human feelings that we can connect with it, even as we understand how it's self-destructive or pull or bullheaded or in some way irrational. And I mean, to answer your initial question, I thought he was a fantastic character. I thought he was one of the most complex and compelling characters I've ever read in a Victorian novel. And
that's one of the reasons I love this novel so much. I think he's awesome.
He's a fantastically developed character, fantastically sketched character, really has, I think, a level of moral ambiguity and a level of kind of ethical complexity and a way in which he makes himself understandable while behaving badly that is, I think, in many ways, I'm not an expert on Victorian literature, but feels to me almost more like something that you would see, you know, decades later, right? Like that level, the advancement of that particular type of craft feels right. very ahead of its time.
Yeah, Go ahead.
I was just going to say, I think that the ability to do that is really rooted in the ability to make his... It's really rooted in grounding everything he does in accessible feelings that are similar to what the reader would have had at some point.
Right. You don't... thinking of other... I'm going to use the word Victorian very broadly here because, like... So Jane Austen is pre-Victorian, but she still draws a lot of comparisons. There's a lot of comparisons between her and Hardy. And then there's other writers like Charlotte Bronte and Anne Bronte, both of whom we have read for this podcast. That. In all of those novels that those broadly speaking Victorian writers have written, I love all of their work for various reasons, but you really don't see a character this morally ambiguous and this well done. Maybe well done is the wrong word, but this morally ambiguous as Henchard is. I really don't see it in any of these other novels. So that's definitely something that Hardy did that is quite important within the annals of literature, I would say.
He feels authentically human in a way that I think, you know, if Charlotte Bronte or Anne Bronte wrote a character like this, you know, in some ways, his temperamentalism, his moodiness, his mercurialism, that's not so far from a Mr. Rochester character, right? But Mr. Rochester right. doesn't really feel like a human being.
Right, exactly.
You know, Heathcliff doesn't really feel like a human being. He's not so different in his way from a Heathcliff, but, you know, those characters are cartoonish in a way that...
Absolutely.
You know, like my grandfather basically was Henchard, my grandfather on my dad's side. Not literally, but, not literally. And he was a teetotaler, right. But you know, he behaved in ways that reflected many of the same passions. I think like being in a room with them would feel very similar. And Dickens, maybe, I think Dickens might've gotten a bit closer to this, but even Dickens, you know, there's, I'm not as familiar with Dickens as I should be, but even a lot of Dickens characters have a kind of exaggeratedness to them that I don't think Henchard does.
I've only read Vanity Fair by Thackeray, but Vanity Fair comes to mind, right? Like Becky Sharp.
Never read Thackeray.
You've never read?
He's somebody that's on my list.
Yeah, I mean, that novel, Becky Sharp is kind of an anti-heroine, problematic character, very, very interesting, and that's kind of why the novel persists today, because people are still fascinated by Becky Sharp, and I guess people are still fascinated by Henchard.
Right. So let's talk specifically about something that you said, Hans. You used the word mercurial to describe Henchard. That's also a word I've used. So I'm interested in this mercurial temperamental, and at one point Hardy uses the word fetishistic to describe Henchard. So what is the purpose of all these traits, and what if it is making a comment on traditional ideas of honor? Like, so for example, in the fight with Farfrae that Henchard has, Henchard, recognizing that he is a bigger man and would easily win in a hand-to-hand fight with Farfrae, ties one hand behind his back to make it a fair fight. Like, you know, this is an example of this idea of honor that Henchard seems to have that is fetishistic. And I'm wondering what reactions you have to that. What do you think the novel's saying about this idea of honor that Henchard seems to portray?
Well, I think it's like you mentioned, sort of how it resonates with the, you know, kind of masculine honor of the time and how that is, you know, sure, portrayed or idealized, a kind of decisiveness and romance in sort of committing to paths. And I think it's, you know, it resonates with ideas of, I think it's useful for Hardy because it's one of the things that complicates Henchard's character, right? Where like his sort of decisive romantic commitment and sudden sort of fetishistic, you know, like swerve from being committed to Lucetta and, you know, recognizing a, you know, a prior superseding obligation and wrong done to his, you know, former wife that he sold, basically breaking it off with Lucetta. Like, there's a lot in that that is very, it's complicating. It complicates the, you know, aspects of his, you know, character that we would like, you know, dislike. But it's also useful craft-wise because a lot of what he goes through is regret, right? Because he just sort of commits to like doing shit. And
he does. You know, when,
and, you know, he hires Farfrae, which turns out to be the right choice, but basically is an asshole to Jop.
Yeah.
And that does not work out well for Henchard because, you know, Jop, you know, basically he leaves Jop, who had, you know, like really did not deserve to be treated the way that he was out on the street. Jop is homeless. Jop is angry. And that is, you know, one of the, you know, things that leads to, you know, one of the tragedies of the novel. So like it's, you know, I think that it's a useful sort of character trait of Henchard's to be, you know, if he is going to be, a kind of problematic character, there is, you know, something in him that we can sort of, admire and then also sympathize with, like Hans said, basically like that sort of conviction, that sort of willingness to deviate from like a prior sort of idea of what, you know, where he was going and then just sort of shift suddenly into this new path. And that being something that is, you know, a kind of a strength in him, but also I guess like, When you admire someone for a character trait, and that character trait is a thing that produces a lot of woe for that character, it really is a good sort of well crafted knot,
right,
for generating sympathy for that character.
Right, absolutely.
So I think that all of it is a very useful craft thing.
And that technique is actually as old as you know, Western literature, going back all the way to Greece with the tragic flaw like Oedipus and you know, other important works from ancient Greece and whatnot.
So thinking about the fetishistic nature and, you know, the dramatic vows in particular, those seemed to me like an expression of the desire for control, right? Partly control sure. of the environment, but then partly also control of himself in a way. I mean, I think that the vows are a way of him showing an understanding that he is an unpredictable person. They're a way of showing his own understanding that he gets away from himself, right? He, you know, sells his wife and daughter, and his way of responding to that is to make a vow not to drink, right? He consciously tries to remove opportunities for himself or situations where he can behave out of turn or behave unpredictably, or you know, he tries to rein in opportunities for himself to be himself in a way, right? They're a way of trying to narrow his own range of movement to improve the outcomes of how he behaves, which I think makes them very poignant for that reason. And I think they're also, some of the things that you might put into that category are also at the same time expressions of trying to gain control in a world that he really can't quite maintain control of, partly because it is in fact kind of a, you know, cutthroat world, but then also because of just reasons of his own not quite having the competence he needs to thrive in the environment he's in, right? Like the decision to, it's not quite an oath, but it feels like kind of the same category when he goes to the fortune teller and has this, has the fortune teller tell him this thing that he then uses as the basis for a bunch of very poor financial decisions, way beyond the point where it's obvious that that was a bad idea, right? Again, that's like him, I think, not really trusting in his own judgment and him trying to exercise control of the world in ways that remove his flawed judgment from, or what he perceives to be his own flawed judgment from the system.
Interesting. That all makes sense. I had not thought of the, you know, his temperamentality, if I want to invent a word, as like example of his inability or his frustration with his inability to control things. That's very interesting.
I really like that. I think he, Henchard, it sounds like Henchard made a lot of sense to you, Hans, and he was a little bit of a mystery, like, to me, like the 21 years commitment to not drinking just because he's 21 years of age, the, you know, like, I've reached the end of my 21 years and I'm going to start drinking again, and kind of like this, I don't know, like, I just really like your grasp of him as a character. Agreed. I don't know that I had that same understanding, but it resonates strongly with me.
I was going to ask, and I think that this is a question that kind of builds on your question, Patrick. Classically, a tragic hero has a flaw, right? There's a key flaw that is responsible for that hero's downfall.
Right.
What is Hinchard's tragic flaw?
I would probably say it is this very temperamental or mercurial nature. That's what it seems like to me, that he does things impetuously without thinking about them, and typically, maybe not without thinking about them, but he does things impetuously, relies on superstition and fetishism to come to his next course of action, and typically it does not turn out well for him. Now, what the substance of the comment is on that that fetishistic nature or that mercurial tragic flaw is, I'm not certain. But I would definitely say that's what seems to get him so into trouble. You know, like, for example, he learns that Elizabeth Jane is not his biological daughter. And he immediately just, because his emotions tell him to, he immediately treats her with coldness and is distant. And this leads to him losing touch with a person that maybe he's not biologically related to, but he could have a reasonably decent relationship with if he made it work. But he simply follows his gut, so to speak, and it ends up bad for him.
And I think that in isolation is less interesting than him basically doubling back entirely on himself and on that sort of snap conviction and lying to her father, right? Because
right.
He lies to her father for the exact opposite reason.
Right.
So it is like this thing in him that is, he's driven by these feelings that are beyond his control. And I think, you know, that is, again, I think it's as much that, you know, Hans, you said that they're feelings we all feel. I think it's as much that the feelings are shown to be, you know, in so much control over him that also invites us to actually care about him even when he's doing these really awful things. Because it's almost like, at this point in time, we know that he's going to be put in a position to regret them. And that is just a pattern of his karma.
Yeah, I don't know how you would summarize this in a single word or phrase, but he has this particular mixture of compassion and anger, that those two qualities work together in ways where if he just had the one or just had the other, he would succeed much more in the world, right? But the interaction between his moments of anger and his moments of compassion create this phenomenon where he's unable to act fully from either motive, and so they, in terms of their effect on his life, kind of cancel each other out in the long run. You know, if he were able to be consistently compassionate and consistently act from his higher self, he'd be fine. And if he were able to really just be a piece of shit, he would do quite well. You know,
right.
But he can't. I mean, if you think about like the whole sequence at the end with Elizabeth Jane and his, if he were able to be fully compassionate and fully understanding and to say to, you know, Newsom, yes, she is actually still alive. She'll be glad to see you. Perhaps he could have salvaged that relationship. And if he were able to truly, you know, drive that compassion from his heart and just let go of his attachment to that person, then, you know, he wouldn't die of a broken heart. But there's something about the way that those two emotions mingle in him that is very authentic and very, very poignant.
Mm-hmm. Agreed. So let's switch topics slightly and go back to what we were first talking about, which is the intricate plot, or what Hans, you said, busy, which I think it is busy. So you've pointed out, Hans, that this is, you know, very Victorian of the novel, you know, its busyness. And one of the ways it achieves this really achieves busyness isn't what it's not trying to achieve busyness, but one of the reasons that it does seem so busy is that we have a lot of very dramatic things happening. So Susan dies, which enables Henchard to court Lucetta again. And then Lucetta dies later, which enables Farfrae to marry Elizabeth Jane, which is what Elizabeth Jane wanted from the beginning. And then there's, like, at the beginning of the novel, or in around chapter 3, we learn that Newsome has been lost at sea, but then later he comes back and he's alive again. So this is within the same kind of realm of, you know, very stunning, dramatic things that happen in the novel. So let's talk about that. You know, what is this? We've already said, at least you said, Hans, that it didn't bother you. Chris, did you have a problem with it? Do you think that these kind of dramatic, not quite believable things happening, or do they lessen the novel? Yes or no? What do you think?
No, the novel moves. It really, it has, it is like not a thriller, obviously, but it is, you know, not sedate. It, you know, basically, like, there's always some kind of tension or conflict,
right,
that's building to some kind of, you know, turn. And I didn't know that this was a serialized work, but it kind of makes sense. It feels a bit like binge watching a television series or something like that, where there is this sort of attention to, you know, the readership and the characters that they're introduced to at, you know, the very beginning or, like, early on. And, you know, the fact that Farfrae is just sort of used as this wandering spousal threat, like, basically, is, you know, I think part of that, where it's like Farfrae is this useful character for that reason. I didn't dislike it.
Didn't bother you?
Didn't bother me at all. Mm-hmm. It was, like I said, it moved.
I agree that it moves, and I like that it moves. You know, one thing I find interesting about this novel is how, how kind of pedestrian all of it is, and yet how much of a page turner it is. Pedestrian in maybe a better word is quotidian, you know, every day, where we're talking about relationships, husband-wife things, father-daughter things, financial decisions that go bad. You know, this is all very everyday type of stuff, and yet I'm hooked. You know, I'm hooked from the first chapter to the last. And so I definitely like those kind of da-da-dum kind of moments. But go ahead.
And I think that those are, that's one way, again, in which this is a bit ahead of its time, I think, right? And this is, again, based somewhat on half-assed internet research. But my understanding is that the publisher and some of the early reviewers of the time were bothered by the fact that there weren't gentry characters, right? That nobody in the novel is... it's not like a lot of literature from this time is focused on rich landowners, essentially, right? And there's always some element of fantasy or escape in something like a Jane Austen novel, where, you know, there's most of the characters are living a very luxurious life by the standard of the time, or even by the standards of our time. And this is
absolutely.
this is a very kind of working class novel, so to speak, before there even was the idea of, you know, a working class culture. And I think that's
one aged thing I wanted incredibly to ask well. A question. Yeah. I totally forgot to ask a question about class because that's that class is extremely important in this novel. But it just slipped my mind to ask a question about, which is weird for me. You know, you would think I would. But that's absolutely.
I was waiting for it.
Yeah. Like I should. I obviously I'm the guy who's going to want to talk about class. But
it's interesting in that way, actually, because, and you can correct me if I'm overlooking anything, but just off the top of my head, there's actually a lot of class mobility in this novel for being set in the time and place that it is. Right. Usually novels about class in this era, you have. The upper class characters tend to be born into that status. But this is actually a novel in which economic mobility is relatively freely available, right? It feels very American in that regard, if that's not in ideal, if not reality, right?
Right.
But that economic mobility does go both ways. I mean, there people are able to gain and lose status in this kind of, you know, at least surface level meritocratic sort of way that it adds a narrative tension that you don't have in a novel where class comes much more from birth and chance.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Henchard himself is an example of how the mobility goes both ways. He starts as a hay trusser, becomes a prosperous corn merchant, which I like. I like calling him a corn merchant instead of a grain dealer, just because it's more fun. And then he loses it all. And I don't know if there, other than just the fact of social mobility along these lines, I don't know what Hardy is necessarily saying about class, other than perhaps he's simply pointing out that, you know, the middle and lower classes of people are worth reading about and worth writing about, which is absolutely something that I, you know, I agree with and think is important.
Sure.
And that actually kind of makes me think about the extra question I added yesterday. Or was that today that I added it? I totally forget. But where this novel takes place in Wessex, which is a fictional county invented by Hardy that is in a rural area southwest of London, west of Sussex, which is a real county. And Wessex being named Wessex for being west of Sussex, obviously. And I was wondering, he writes a lot of his novels take place in Wessex. Tons of his short stories takes place in Wessex. And one thing that is universal to all of his Wessex stories is that he uses rural characters that we would think of as, say, lower to middle class peasants who probably make their living through farming or some other agrarian activity. And a lot of the character of the county and of the Wessex universe is given by these lower class or middle class people. So maybe I just answered my own question, like, why is this novel taking place in Wessex? Why is that significant? Is there any other way in which you think this fact might be significant other than what I've just said? Or, you know, do you agree with me or disagree with me?
I think it's a technique that's been used a lot of different ways. You know, I don't know, like, it'd be interesting to know when that, like, technique was first used.
Right.
Like, It occurred to me while I was just thinking about that, like, you know, are there any sort of ancient, you know, plays or myths on which, you know, the speculation about the existence of some long lost city has built, you know, up over time, where that long lost city was just some, you know, narrative device, you know, like Atlantis doesn't actually exist. It's just sort of, I think that, you know, actually Atlantis doesn't exist. Atlantis is a kind of a platonic kind of construction to basically kind of create something that is adjacent to a city in real life, you know, ideologically, and then explore some, you know, philosophical ideas through. So I guess I guess that is true. I don't know. People have been doing that for
a
long time.
Yeah, it's been around forever.
Atlantis, and this is based off of, not a lot of research into it, but basically a few things that I've read about Atlantis and speculation about, you know, where it started and whether it was totally just solely something that Plato constructed out of whole cloth in order to explore some philosophical ideas. If we do treat it that way, then you construct a fictional city in that sense to basically, kind of like science fiction, build, you know, certain structures in that space that you can then explore and write about and sort of isolate.
Right.
And so is he doing that in Wessex?
Is Hardy doing that here? I would think that, part of what he does with Wessex is he's interested in rurality. Again, if I can invent a word, he's interested in the rural aspect of English life, and he creates all these rural characters with these rural Cockney style accents, even though Cockney is not rural. It's actually based on class. You know, people of a lower class in England speak Cockney, or at least traditionally that's the idea. I don't know how true that is, but, you know, he creates these rural lower class characters in order to, I think, explore rural lower class issues. And that's one reason to create Wessex might be to specifically address issues that, in the same way that Plato is doing, you know, construct this universe in that, so that you can comment on the actual universe. Okay, so moving on to our final topic for the podcast. A colleague of mine, when I worked at Cincinnati State as an English teacher and a writing center tutor, she pointed out to me that she had a lot of strong negative reactions to Hardy's characterizations of women. So let's talk about the three main female characters, Elizabeth Jane, Susan, and Lucetta, and how do we feel about how he sketches them out, how Hardy sketches them out?
Well, they definitely don't have the depth and complexity of Hinchard. I mean, to be fair, I don't know that any of the characters really have much depth or complexity other than Hinchard.
Yeah.
There's so much quality to how, so much complexity and nuance to how Hinchard is sketched. Farfrae is pretty one-dimensional, really. I mean, he's just a good guy who's competent at everything, right? Jop is just kind of a surly, grudgy asshole.
Women love Farfrae.
Yeah, there aren't that many other characters, really. I do think that none of them, for the most part, none of them really get a lot of... they don't get as much space as they could to kind of reveal a lot of depth. Susan just kind of flits around the margins and dies, you know.
Yeah.
Elizabeth Jane
really just serves some plot interests.
Yeah. I mean, I think all three of them, I don't think any of the three of them are, at least I don't find them offensive necessarily, right? I don't think that they are, I wouldn't call them misogynistic. They're just one-dimensional characters who are kind of in the shadow of a more fully written character. If you think about like this novel relative to the only other Hardy that I've read, and there actually is a podcast episode on it. I read it for a very early episode of this pod, but Jude the Obscure. I can understand how you would be offended as a woman by the portrayal of the wife in Jude the Obscure, if I remember that novel correctly.
Jude's first wife, Arabella, or his love interest, what's her name? I think her name is Susan, too.
Arabella's the mean one, right?
Yeah, Arabella's the first one who is very mercurial and, like, you know, she goes out to get laid when Jude, at the end, is dying.
Right. Right, right. I can see why you might be offended by the portrayal of Arabella. I mean, she doesn't really have the complexity. You can imagine the character being written with the sympathy and complexity of a Henchard, and she doesn't have it, right? She's kind of this cartoon of vileness. I don't think there's anything drastically wrong with these characters other than they're arrows that only point one direction, you know?
Sure. Yeah. I would say the only one who is even close to being a better character is Elizabeth Jane, but still she doesn't really rise out of one dimensionality either. Not really.
It doesn't strike me as being drastically worse than many, many, many other novels from the time or from any time.
Sure. No.
It's not
You're
good.
Right.
Sorry, what were you gonna say, Chris?
Well, I was going to say, I think that basically the it's not problematic, but basically, you know, when the women are given sort of cause to react in ways that are maybe more interesting than they are, Lucetta being spurned by Henchard and sent a check. Elizabeth Jane realizing that Henchard has lied to her real father about you know, her, and she actually does have a real reaction there, and that I guess like brings her a little bit further out of the page and rejects Henchard. And there is just like I think a lack of that feels like, you know, I guess it is just sort of the female characters being one, you know, one dimensional. But if, you know, basically if like you're reading this with your kid and you're talking about like, you know, how the female characters are portrayed and you're, you know, trying to kind of like draw attention to things that, you know, like, you know, maybe like you should be aware of, with women and the portrayal of women over time, you know, just having them meekly accept, you know, abusive treatment is something to point out.
Right.
I think that they're, you know, they're not portrayed in ways that are like, you know, grotesque in any way. They're just meek. And that is, you know, It's probably the biggest problem that I have with the novel is that they're not interesting.
Yeah.
In any way.
It is a problem. You know, Susan, the whole plot of the novel kind of turns on Susan's being willing to, you know, just accept that she's been sold. Like she's not.
And then her husband's like, "You're so stupid to have believed."
Right. You know.
Just like, oh my God, dude.
So we do have to point out that my colleague from Cincinnati State has a point. You know, these characterizations of women could be better. Maybe they're not worse than anyone else from the time. And being of the time that he was from, we can expect Hardy to do this simply because this is how women were thought of as kind of simple, in one-dimensional, you know, creatures. But with our modern minds, we can say this kind of sucks, man. We wish you had done better, right?
I think you only make Henshard more interesting if you put more interesting people around.
Sure,
him. Like I think that's kind of a you know, it's not necessarily how this book was written because it was more plot, maybe, but it's too bad that Elizabeth Jane isn't Becky Sharp. You know, right. isn't a little bit nastier? Isn't a little bit like, you know, I don't know.
No, I think that agreed.
Those women characters do exist in that time. It's not, but they only exist as exceptions right. to the rule. So,
okay. So that's our take on that. Listeners, you've been listening to our podcast on Thomas Hardy's The Mayor of Casterbridge, which really gives us an awesome, interesting kind of anti-protagonist or anti-hero protagonist who is deeply flawed, morally ambiguous, but also deeply empathetic for all those flaws and deeply interesting, but does fail in the you know, interesting female characters department. So, seems like it's Chris, it's your turn to pick. What are we reading next?
You guys picked for me, man. It's got to be Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy now.
Oh, okay.
yeah.
All right.
Because, like, Patrick, I had no idea that you had read it.
I've never. And so we're talking, like, the first one in the series, right?
Just the first one. Yeah. Okay. Just the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
Oh, that'll be fun. That'll definitely, you know, help me enjoy one shift of my job as a. a Cincinnati letter.
You gotta read it. Let's record the podcast in 2 days because Patrick will be done that quickly.
Yeah. It'll help me enjoy one shift. Okay. Cool. So, what's his name?
Douglas Adams.
Douglas Adams, Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy is what we're gonna talk about next. I hope you've enjoyed this podcast episode. Peace out, and as always, fuck the fash.